Sidepod Space, the final frontier. This is the maiden voyage of Sidepod Radio. A 60 minute mission to explore new worlds, seek out new life and new civilization, to boldly go where no podcast has gone before. Well, okay, we're going to talk about space and stuff. I'm sure that people listening today who are not regular visitors to the comments at Sidepodcast, they're wondering why I'm doing a show about space. It all started one day last year when I mentioned in the comments that I was watching the preparations for a space shuttle launch. And as normally happens in these situations, a few questions were asked and answered, and ended up with a whole load of us watching the launch. And of course, since the launch was over, people wanted to know why it was being launched, where it was going, what it was going to do. And we ended up watching, you know, almost every day of the mission to the space station, and then the landing. And since then, we've watched other missions. We've watched the mission to the Hubble Space Telescope, where it was repaired and tuned up. And we're going to sort of discuss some of the things that have been brought up in the comments recently. We're going to do things on space rocks and why Sidepodcast is obsessed with cryogenically freezing Bruce Willis before it's too late. What happens when a big rock, a planet, as happened in Jupiter recently. We'll do a bit on manned exploration, and we'll do a bit on the sky. Is it space, or is it not space, and how many elephants does it weigh? We're also going to answer the question as to whether there was ever a Major Tom who flew in space, and that's got to be worth listening to. I've also got loads of questions from the commenters. If you've got any questions as the show goes on, feel free to ask them in the comments, or if you want to phone in, I'll discuss it. I'll sort of deal with any of those as we go. Right. First thing I'm going to do is space rocks and Bruce Willis. NASA maintains a list of potentially hazardous asteroids. Now, I checked this on Friday, and there were 1,071 of them. I checked it just before the show, and they found another two. So it's all sorts of rocks flying about up there, which crash into each other and crash into planets and into stars and things. The whole space is basically a massive cosmic car crash. And we all know about the dinosaurs being wiped out. But, you know, all these things hit Earth, some of the small ones hit Earth. But the good thing is, you don't need to worry today. Today, there is nothing passing anywhere near Earth. So you're quite safe. Tomorrow, on the other hand, is a different matter. Tomorrow there's a little space rock, which NASA says between 85 and 190 meters in diameter, which is passing within 0.2 of an astronomical unit of Earth. Now, 0.2 of an astronomical unit an astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the Sun. 0.2 means it's 20% away from the Sun, which sounds like a long way. But you have to remember, in our orbit around the Sun, we cover a mean diameter of 2 astronomical units. So really, the difference between this hitting us and missing us is simply a few days along that line. The thing you have to also remember is these things are going at insane speeds in relation to the Earth. So if they hit, it's a big problem. This particular one that's flying by tomorrow is traveling at 18 kilometers a second in relation to the Earth. So you can imagine something 100 meters in diameter, 18 kilometers a second. If that hits, we're all going to know about it. We're fine for a few days after that, really. But on September the 29th, there are not one, but two rocks coming close. The closest one is 0.02 of an astronomical unit, which is effectively 8.5 times the distance to the Moon, or 2 million miles. Now remember, we're doing 2 astronomical units diameter around the Sun, which is 186 million miles. This thing is missing us by 8 million miles. And this is fairly big. This is 340 to 760 meters in diameter, traveling at 18 kilometers a second in relation to us. The other rock that day, it's a bit further away. It's 20 times the distance to the Moon, or 5 million miles. But it's a monster. It's between sort of half a kilometre and 1.5 kilometres in diameter. So we need to sort out a plan with Bruce now to sort this out. That one's not the biggest rock we're going to see this year, though. On October the 28th, we get one between 1.5 and 3.5 kilometers in diameter, passing within 0.1 of an astronomical unit, at a relative speed of 25 kilometers a second. Between now and end of the year, we have 60 space rocks which are being tracked. There's all sorts of other stuff up there not being tracked, or that hasn't been found yet, or that doesn't come under the classification. You know, if there's a comet or something going around, that doesn't count. So we've got 60 rocks that they know about, and bear in mind they found two in the past day, which have come close to the Earth. The closest one is going to be 0.017 of an astronomical unit, which equates to 1.7 million miles. Just as a little example, something that happened recently. People think big rocks hit planets and kill dinosaurs, and then 100 million years later, maybe another one happens. There was a rock hit Jupiter recently, and I'll post a link in the comments so that people can see the picture of it. The rock landed, or arrived at Jupiter near its south pole, smashed into it at ridiculous speed, and left what looks like a little black gash near its south pole on the picture. So what you have to picture in your mind is, imagine Jupiter is the size of Earth, and just work out in your mind the area that that gash covers. It probably looks like the size of a small country.
New Zealand. To pick one.
Don't say that. Right.
I could have said Wales.
Now what you have,
oh, well,
what you have to realise, yeah.
Sorry, Amy.
I think New Zealand is further away. What you have to realise now is Jupiter isn't the same size as Earth. It's 11.2 times the size of Earth. So any dimension you pick on that gash is 11 times bigger and covers 120 times the area you thought it did. So imagine the damage something like that could have done to Earth.
120 times bigger than New Zealand?
That's like the whole of the Earth.
120 times the area of New Zealand. Now, the thing you've got to remember is Jupiter is just a big ball of gas. It doesn't have a solid planet with a little bit of atmosphere on top. Almost all the way down, it's just gas. Massively compressed gas, but it's gas. The rock that hit it, they think, was the size of a few football fields. It ploughed in through the atmosphere, and once it got a few miles down, built up so much friction, it exploded, and threw plumes of smoke and dust up thousands of miles into space, which then fell back. And the black mark you see is a sort of carbonaceous residue. The rock the size of a few football fields that hit it has never been seen. No one knew it was coming. No one knew it existed. The first anyone knew about that was when an amateur Australian astronomer noticed a black mark on the planet one night when he's observing it. So just imagine, Jupiter is only two planets out from us. There's us, Mars, Jupiter. And a rock the size of several football fields hit it, and no one saw it. So just imagine what could have happened to us if something like that had arrived and we didn't know about it. And it begs the question, if we cryogenically freeze Bruce Willis, what can he do for us if he doesn't know the rock's there? Right, so it's, you know, we need to start monitoring these things.
So is there a solution to this?
Yeah. We need to get countries observing up there. You got all these people who are worried about, you know, global warming and all the kind of stuff that's going on with the Earth and the Earth's atmosphere. Well, it's fine keeping all that nicely and neatly maintained. But if there's something flying around the size of several football fields that can wipe out an area 120 times the size of New Zealand, what's the point? It'd be far better diverting a load of energy up there to sticking more observatories up, more telescopes like Hubble or all the other great telescopes we've got up there, and just mapping everything that's up there. Because anything that's within several hundred million miles of us can wipe us out. And there's an awful lot falls into that territory. So it's something that has to be worried about.
So how did Bruce know it was up there?
Well, I'll tell you what. I remember the film, and because film is actual fact, isn't it, all the time, with Bruce Willis
Absolutely. Telling
the truth all the time. So they said that they were upset that they didn't find it until it was like however long away it was, a week or 2 weeks. And he said that's because they only can look at about 1% of the sky, and that's why. And it just happened that it passed into the right 1%, I guess. Bruce was just lucky.
But the last thing anyone saw hit Jupiter, there was a comet about 18 years ago. It was called Shoemaker-Levy 9, sorry to insult the guy. And it was basically split up into a number of like football-sized type pieces, sort of bigger than that. I think it's like 1 kilometer type pieces. And it ended up being like 8 or 9 of them. So they were able to track that because it was a predictable comet. But they picked it up a few weeks in advance, and it was literally 2 or 3 weeks in advance. So they're able to observe the bits hitting, the reaction that got from the atmosphere, and that is why they can calculate what this rock was that hit recently. So they've actually observed stuff hitting Jupiter, but that had 2 weeks' notice, and that was 8 or 9 pieces. It was a huge comet, and no one saw it coming until 2 weeks in advance.
Good stuff. But Simon has a comment for a question for you, and I think he wants to ring in. Do you want to take calls now or in a bit?
Yeah, if he's got a question now, I'll take a question now.
You happy to call us, Bassano? We are ready. We are waiting for your call.
As long as it doesn't ask me about space shuttle suspensions using push rods or pull rods, I'm fine.
Hello, Bassano.
Hello there.
You can hear us.
Yep.
What's your question for Stephen?
I wanted to know how I wanted to know how Stephen felt about Pluto being declassified as a planet.
That's a great question.
As Bassano clearly knows, I think a year, maybe two ago, they decided to declassify Pluto and call it a dwarf planet. And there's a perfectly good reason for that. There are, and it's just outside or around the area of Pluto, going out for, I think it's something like a couple of hundred light years. It's an enormous distance, or not light years, a couple of hundred million miles or something. There are what they call the Kuiper Belt, which is basically a whole load of pieces of dust and little bits of rock and other dwarf planets. And there's also, and it comes up in one of the later questions, inside Jupiter, between Jupiter and Mars, there's an asteroid belt, and there's also a dwarf planet in amongst all the gubbins that's flying around there. So they had the choice. They could either have 8 planets and discount Pluto, which was a manageable number that people can learn and start to understand a bit about, or they have to start adding in all these dwarf planets. And, some of those they probably don't even know about yet because they haven't identified them, because there are literally millions and millions of pieces of stuff flying around out there. So they have to either say, there's 8 planets, this is what they are, this is where they are, this is how they orbit the Earth, how they orbit the Sun, these are the moons that go around them. Or they have to start adding in dwarf planets, and, who knows how many you end up with. And it ends up being a bit weird after that, because people are never going to learn them. They don't go and, just now effectively have very loosely concentric orbits of the planets. Once you start adding in dwarf planets, there's another one actually rotates around Jupiter, around Pluto. So two of them are actually orbiting each other all the time. And it ends up being very messy. And there's no way you can explain the basics of it to people if you start off with a complete chaotic mess. So I'm quite happy it's been declassified, because it's far better than the other alternative.
What do you make of it, Bassano? Sorry.
I just think that Pluto should have been given grandfather rights, because we all went to school and learnt that it was a planet. I understand the reasons why, but it's Pluto. When I was a kid, Pluto was a planet.
And a dog in the Disney cartoons. I wonder if he's been dropped as well.
There is that.
Maybe a mouse now.
Pluto's, maybe Pluto's not a dog anymore.
I don't suppose it can be a mouse, because that would be promotion in Disney World.
Anyway, we digress. Thanks for the answer, Stephen.
No problem. What I'm going to do now is, since we've lost a bit of time, I'm going to go straight into the questions that people have left either on the wiki page or on the show post I put up and try and deal with those. And the first one's from Christine.
Uh-oh.
It says, can you tell me about the bits that fall off the space shuttle as it's going into space? Which is a really nice, easy question to start with. 2 minutes into the flight, the two solid rocket boosters get jettisoned. Now those are, for those of you who are not familiar with the shuttle, I've seen pictures of it, those are the two kind of white candly things on the side, which are basically full of solid rocket fuel. So those are used basically to get it off the ground. Those get ditched and are parachuted back to Earth. Now, as well as being reused, those also hold film cameras. So as soon as they're found, the film canisters are taken out and sent away to be analysed, because they're actually filming the underside of the shuttle to make sure there's no damage to it, or to identify and quantify damage. The next thing that gets jettisoned is the big external fuel tank, which is a big sort of cylindrical thing that holds half a million US gallons of rocket fuel. And that goes about 8 minutes into the flight, 8.5 minutes. And as well as being parachuted and reused, that also has a sort of live video recording of the ascent. So that's sent away and analysed as well. And it's one of the ways where the shuttle is a vast improvement on what went before. Because when you look at what went before, there was all sorts of pieces falling all over the place and none of it recovered. The only other piece you'll ever see used on the shuttle is, like last week where it landed in Edwards Air Force Base in California, what they have to do is stack it on top of a specially modified Boeing 747. And to make it slightly aerodynamic, which the shuttle really isn't, they put a specially shaped fairing, like its own personal double diffuser, behind the engines and behind the tail section to just lean out the aerodynamics and make it a bit more efficient. But if you compare the space shuttle with something like Apollo, if you take a standard Apollo moon mission, the first thing that gets jettisoned there, the Saturn V rocket, was basically three rocket stages built one on top of each other. So if you imagine the external fuel tank with two solid rocket boosters under it. So a few minutes into the flight, the first stage rocket was jettisoned because its job was simply get it off the ground. Then there's a little piece of what looks like the ring round the outside of the rocket gets jettisoned, which they call the interstage. And that's basically to clear a path for the engines to use on the second stage. The second stage took the Apollo into Earth orbit. The first two bits that get jettisoned onto the ground or into the sea and just disappeared. Once it's in Earth orbit, the second stage gets jettisoned and the next interstage gets jettisoned and just left in Earth orbit to eventually just burn up in the atmosphere. After that, the third stage is fired to take it to the moon. Actually, I think they actually take out the lunar module, because what happens is, if you picture the rocket stack, at the top of the stack you have the command module, which is a little capsule bit, and underneath that there's a little engine section, and then below that they actually store the lunar module, the bit that lands on the moon. So what happens is, in Earth orbit, the capsule and its engine disengage, rotate 180 degrees, and the capsule goes in nose first to pick the lunar module out. And the lunar module is shielded by four panels. Those are blown off with explosive bolts and burn up in the atmosphere. You can see the waste of it into this. The lunar module is then pulled out. The whole assembly that's in the move now just turns round and backs back into the third stage. The third stage fires, takes them out of Earth orbit towards the moon, and once its fuel's burnt up, it's dumped. And another little interstage goes, and it sort of flops about in somewhere between here and the moon. And then you have the command module, which is basically the main capsule with the sort of engine stuff attached to it, with the lunar module nose to nose to the main capsule. They go around the moon a few times, and eventually two of the guys in the command module go into the lunar module, and that separates off and goes down onto the moon. Once they've done the little walk and collect a bit of rock, the bottom half of the lunar module stays on the moon, and it acts as a solid base to blast off the top half of the lunar module. That comes up, plugs back onto the command module. The two guys and all the rocks and stuff they've collected come into the main capsule again. They then jettison the lunar module, except for Apollo 13, where they were living in it by this stage. But they jettison the lunar module and blast it into the moon's sort of gravity field and onto the surface of the moon, because they use that to trigger all the seismic detectors that they've planted. The command module, complete with capsule and engine bit, head back to Earth, and the engine part then gets jettisoned in Earth orbit. And then the shuttle actually lands. Now, if you picture the capsule, if you picture the shuttle and how much of it actually lands at the end, with the Apollo, you've got 300 plus feet of rocket stack at the start. Of that, 11 feet of capsule actually makes it back to the end, and everything else is trashed. So the shuttle is a far more efficient vehicle in that sense. So I hope that answers Christine's question.
That's lovely, thank you.
Right, the next one is from Jordan, saying, why is there an asteroid field between Mars and Jupiter? Which is actually quite correct. He thought he corrected himself on it, but he's correct. Normally, all the bits that fly around there, and what you're talking about is effectively a ring several million miles in width, which flies around there, including one of the dwarf planets which I mentioned earlier on Ceres. Whole load of rocks, ranging from bits of dust up to fairly substantial rocks. The dwarf planet that's floating around there is something like 400 metres in diameter, so it's a fairly hefty lump of rock. Now, normally what would happen as the solar system formed is that all those would gradually accrete, is the technical term they use, but those would gradually pull together and form a planet or two, or form a planet and a moon or something like that. But because Jupiter is so massive, in terms of mass, Jupiter is something like, I've got a note of it here somewhere and I can't remember where it is. Jupiter is something like 300 times the mass of the Earth. So though it's all gas, there is a lot of gas there. And if you take all the planets put together, Jupiter has 2.5 times the mass of all the other planets put together. So it's a huge influence in how the solar system mechanics behave. And basically it has such a huge gravitational field that instead of all the stuff that's circulating around in the asteroid belt slowing and building together, every time they come near Jupiter's orbit, they just accelerate, and there's so much energy built up in there that none of these things can to any degree combine, because as soon as a few of them get together, they go near Jupiter, it accelerates them and they go smash into other bits and break up into dust. So the reason we have an asteroid belt is because of Jupiter, and the reason Earth is protected from a lot of space rocks coming and smashing into us is because Jupiter's gravity field is so huge, it collects them and pulls them in and effectively creates a temporary moon out of them, like the Schumacher-Levy comet, because the reason they could predict it hitting Jupiter was because it got pulled into orbit and orbited for a couple of weeks. Okay, while we find RG's question in the comments, and someone can boost it up if I can't find it, I've got another question from Christine. Okay. Do you think people in the International Space Station get bored in the evenings? And do they have evenings?
These great are really question. Important questions, you know.
You need to know. Well, the beauty of being on the International Space Station is that you get two kinds of evenings. Imagine you're on a long space flight to Mars. It'd be daylight all the time because you're always in direct line with the sun. But because the space station's only a couple of hundred miles up, half the time the Earth is between it and the sun. So they have what they call orbital day and orbital night. And one day of that lasts an hour and a half. So every hour and a half, they have 3/4 of an hour of evening or night. But those are just ignored because they're working. But in their actual work days, they are scheduled to have time off in the evenings, as well as the occasional day off. So they must find ways of entertaining themselves. I know they can telephone home, they can email people, they have internet access, and I'm sure they must have invented the odd game or two up there.
Do you think they play Scrabble?
I'm sure. Or Solitaire or something. It might be complicated playing Scrabble with a number of nationalities up there, but especially if the Russians sent the game up, that would cause confusion. But, you know, there are things you can do. They now have the Colbert treadmill up there, and they had a previous one because one of the the previous female astronauts actually ran the Detroit Marathon in space while she was on the shuttle. So she started at the same time, and the treadmill actually calculated distance, and she actually ran the Detroit Marathon while she was in space. So they do sort of, you know, they do have enough things to entertain them.
That's
quite a bit fun. You got a great view. Yeah.
Do they have iPods in space?
Oh, they must have.
How do they sync
them? They must
have.
Do they have iTunes in space?
I don't know. They can tweet from space. They must be able to do that. Why do planets have different orbits around the sun? Aha. Awesome question. Really wish I'd had that one up front and I'd read into it and understood it. But effectively, everything that's flying around in space is affected by the gravity pull of everything else around it. So you end up with things, and I won't tackle planets as such, but there's one I was reading about recently about moons of Jupiter. There are four what they call Galilean moons of Jupiter, which are the four first discovered ones, which are fairly big. And it gives a good idea of how the various gravities affect. Obviously, the gravity pull of Jupiter, as I said, is humongous. It's way bigger than anything else near us. And as a result of that, some of the moons that go around Jupiter are actually heated because they suffer from the same effect that we suffer from our moon. You imagine our moon goes round and affects the tides on Earth. You imagine instead of the moon affecting us, we're affecting the moon, which we are to an extent because we're keeping it in orbit. But if we were 300 times the mass of the Earth, what happens is every time the moon goes past, it actually gets distorted. And because it gets distorted, it's creating seismic activity in the middle of it. And that generates heat in it, which is why they think some of the best places for life in the whole solar system are some of the moons of Jupiter and of Saturn. Now, one of the weird things that happens with Jupiter's moons is there's two of them, and I can't remember which two it is, but one orbits next to Jupiter, and it goes round the planet every 2 days. The next moon out, by sheer luck, because of the way all the crashes that have happened up there have occurred, goes round every 4 days. So you get this weird situation where every two days, these two line up and produce weird forces on each other and are keeping each other in that cycle. So you end up with, to answer RG's question with planets, imagine you've got this little dwarf planet, Ceres, which is in the asteroid belt. The reason it's got an odd-shaped orbit is because once every year of its travel around the sun, whatever a year is for it, it appears, you know, this huge planet appears next to it and just yanks it out of the path it's in and pulls it into a new one. So you've got that going on all the way through. So we're affecting the moon, we're affecting Venus, which is a planet inside us, and Mercury, the planet inside that. You've got all these space rocks that Bruce is going to protect us from smashing into each other and just, you know, moving things out of orbit. And the reason we have the moon in the first place, the best guess anyone has in that, is at one point the moon and the Earth were the same body, but a planet or something the size of Mars came in and just smashed into the side of us. So forget about rocks killing dinosaurs. This thing smashed in early in the formation of the solar system and knocked a lump off of our planet. Now, gradually the Earth pulled together as a ball and had a ring of dust and rocks and God knows what all around it, in the same way that Saturn and other planets have today, and that gradually formed the moon. So basically the reason things have different orbits is they're all been affected by different gravitational pulls and different collisions. So I hope that made sense.
It does. And in the meantime, have you seen Bassano's excellent question?
No.
Question is from Bassano.
I can't read and talk.
In space, which way is up, and how come all the starships in Star Trek point the same way up?
Oh, so we're doing science fiction now. the bottom line is there is no up in space. There's no up, no down, no left, no right, nothing. I think the reason the starships do that is because it's the easiest way for the people who make it to make it happen. But I've actually got something coming up later on artificial gravity which may answer some of that. I've got another question from Christine next on my list. She's obviously had lots of questions. I read somewhere that Mars is going to be the closest it's been to the Earth for about 60,000 years or something before drifting away again. Are we missing a golden opportunity to start colonising it? Well, unfortunately, we're a very long way from colonising Mars. After the Apollo 17, which was the last moon landing, everyone kind of sat back and said, okay, we've done exploration, we've been to the moon, we found the Genesis rock, so there's no need to go back there. The Genesis rock, I should explain, was found by Apollo 15. And what the Genesis rock proved is it had originally been part of Earth. It was the first thing it found, because most of the stuff on the surface of the moon is dust from things impacting it, which is why it's all, its whole face is all pockmarked and get dents all over it. But Apollo 15 found what's called the Genesis rock, and that was proved to be part of Earth, and it proved that the moon and the Earth had once been the same body. So once they'd done that, they said, okay, it's not cheese. We're okay, we know what it is. They sat back, and basically the Americans and the Soviet Unions chucked up a couple of space stations. The Americans put up Skylab, Soviet Union put up Mir, and they played with them for a while. And these were, you know, tiny in comparison with the current space station. And I think the problem was, we went to the moon too early, because JFK in his famous speech said that we're going to send a man to the moon before the end of this century and return them safely to the Earth. By the end of the decade, sorry, not a century. And once they sort of pushed everything out to do that, and took insane risks to do it, they really didn't have anything to prove. What they should have done is just said, okay, we're not going to make that target, but with the Cold War on and everything, it had to be done. And really, sometime in the 1980s, people should have started working together to create a moon base, and then we could have been going to Mars now, but no one was looking that far ahead. So I think, you know, there's no chance we're going to go to Mars in the very near future. It's going to be at least 20, 30 years before that happens. Next question is not from Christine, it's from Amy. It says, what is the next step in the US program after the retired space shuttles? And how long until we get to watch again? Well, as things stand just now, the next shuttle mission is STS-129. The last scheduled mission is 134, which means there are 6 shuttle missions left. Now, the problem is, America then has a gap of, it foresees just now being 6 or 7 years before the shuttle replacement vehicle is ready, which means they've got 6 or 7 years before they can launch a man into space on anything apart from a Russian Soyuz. And I'm sure America doesn't want to be seen to have no way of getting to the space station or no way of getting a man in space without using Russian technology. They're looking at things just now as options, and the most sensible one seems to be to extend the life of the shuttle. But as you can imagine, flying the shuttle is an expensive business. So they're trying to find ways of sorting out the budgets and, you know, trying to find an alternative. The first launch of what they're calling Ares 1X, which is the sort of important part of the shuttle replacement, which is called the Constellation Project, you can actually watch the first test launch of that, which is on October the 31st. So that's going to be interesting to watch to see how that goes. And I think about a week or 2 weeks, I think either November 9th, November the 12th, the next shuttle's due to go. So we're going to have a busy spell of space stuff around about then, especially if we get the usual delays. You're going to end up interfering with one another. But they've now got to a stage where, even if they do extend the shuttle launch, there are two launch pads, 39A and 39B, where they launched the shuttle from. 39B has now been converted to take Ares Constellation, so they can only ever have one shuttle in the pad again unless they have to go back and undo it all. Next question I have is from Nikki, which says, how do they take pictures of galaxies far, far away? Now, I really need a photographic expert for this, because I'm no expert on this. But effectively, it's the same as using a normal camera. You've got to look at it for a very long time and collect all the data that they can get from that. Now, doing that from Earth is pretty much impossible because the atmosphere gets in the way. Now, it's one of the advantages of global warming. If it drives the atmosphere off, we'll be able to observe space really well. But, yeah, there's some downsides to that. But since they've started launching the Hubble Space Telescope and some of the other observatories that are up there, they've been able to take these incredible pictures. And I'll post a link now of the latest ones from Hubble. They appeared in the comments a couple of days ago or a week ago. But those are basically done with the new updated Hubble, where we saw the shuttle mission go up and tune it up and put some new instruments on it. And basically all they do is they point Hubble in one direction and focus on a very small area and hold that exposure as long as they can. And that's how it's done. And basically Hubble has inside it is a mirror which collects light and puts it onto a point source. And effectively the bigger and the better the surface of the mirror, the more data you collect. Got a brilliant unexpected question which popped up on the wiki page from someone called Gufasi, who I've never seen the comments before. And it's about if they held a GP on Pluto. And rather than asking the more logical question about how they get there, how do they cover it, what he wants to know about is downforce settings. So, the thing is, on Pluto, there is only a temporary atmosphere. So, you don't really need to worry about downforce settings, because there's no atmosphere to create downforce. Which is good, because it means we get rid of wings and have proper racing again. Unfortunately, there are one or two minor problems associated with not having an atmosphere. First of all, the drivers can't actually breathe. So we need to get drivers into spacesuits, and we also need to find a way of, if there's an accident, getting the driver out and getting them into an airtight environment where they can actually get a spacesuit on and start doing some medical procedures on them. As well as the driver, the engines need air to work. So as well as the fuel tank, they're going to end up with a huge air tank built in. So fortunately, downforce and aerodynamics is not an issue, because this car is going to be huge. And as well as the air for getting the engine to work, you also need air for cooling engines and brakes. So we have to find a way of setting up refrigeration systems. So in the end, the aerodynamics is really the least of the problem. His follow-up question was, would Schumacher be able to park on a hairpin better with minimal gravity?
Who asked these questions? I heart these.
This is Gufazi.
I love Gufazi. Them.
The good thing with that is, with less G-force and less downforce, there's more chance of him actually hitting the barrier, because he's not going to have to judge it as well. And since the brakes are liable to overheat, he's unlikely to be able to apply them in time to stop. So he may actually hit the barrier properly and do himself some damage. Next question I have. No, we're in for time. Oh, we're over time.
That's fine.
That's right, you carry on.
You just woke us up with a very loud microphone.
Ah, okay.
That's okay.
The next question comes from Celador. And it's basically on the budget spent in space. It says, space travel is like mega expensive. Is it worth spending all those billions and maybe trillions of dollars on it when something could be done about reducing world poverty or fighting cancer and AIDS with the same resources? Are the scientific discoveries going to be important or as useful as that? Or are we doing this exploration out of some primeval desire for exploration to fulfill personal ambitions, the dreams of those involved, while overlooking the greater needs of the many? And he sums that up by saying, well, that's a question wrapped in another question inside a bigger question, but it's pretty heavy stuff. Which, fair enough, it is heavy stuff. And it is a great question, but as we discussed near the top of the show, long term, if we stay on the planet, cure all those diseases, wipe out poverty, a big rock's going to come and wipe us out, just like it did with the design, the dinosaurs, and it may be bigger and do more damage. So at some point, we have to find a way of getting off the planet. We have to find somewhere to go. We have to find some way to live once we get there, or we're toast. Space toast. So, assuming we don't get hit by some miracle, we don't get hit by a rock or by Mars, because there's a theory now that Mars's orbit is so destabilized that in several thousand years, there's a possibility that Mars and Earth will crash, and probably another lump of Earth will get knocked off, and a lump of Mars will get knocked off, and there won't be any of us left to see it. But at some point, something big is going to hit us, so we have to get off the planet. The other thing is, you have to realise there are a lot of short-term immediate benefits to being involved in space. If you look at the International Space Station just now, there are actually five separate space agencies working on that. There's NASA, the Russians, European Space Agency, ESA, JAXA, the Japanese agency, and Canada. So you've got all these countries pulling together, working together, communicating better, and sharing the benefits, which has to be a good thing given the world that some of us grew up in. There's also discussions going on just now that rather than NASA doing its own moon mission and then Mars mission, those five agencies will come together again, possibly with the addition of China and India. Now bear in mind, put it all together. One country makes life easier. But China and India between them have a third of the world's populations. So to get all of those working with the existing five, it's got to be good for the long-term state of the planet, even if it only stops us shooting and killing each other. And one of the best ways to encourage international peace is to get people working together. And it also keeps communication channels open. So even if there's some major political disturbance, there's still a way for people to communicate by backdoor means to, you know, get them talking to each other. And we all know from the sort of terrorism problem in Ireland, eventually it was the talking through backdoor channels that sorted the problem. So if we end up with a couple of countries pointing nuclear weapons at each other, it may be that the space program is the backdoor method to keep the communication flowing and to sort out the problem. It's also impossible, you have to realise, to put people on the moon or Mars for prolonged periods without there being some substantial scientific dividend. Now, what those dividends are going to be is anyone's guess, but we do know that anyone up there is going to have very few resources available. They're going to have to recycle everything on a scale that people can't imagine now. And given the rise in population and climate change and so on, any benefit we get back from those has got to be worth having. So as well as finding us a way to get off this planet when we're screwed here, it also may help us to keep this planet together for a long time. Drink. Got another one from Celador. Simulated gravities on starships is all the rage, but is it science fiction or is it really possible? Well, I'm going to go all scientific on you now. There was an incredible German theoretical physicist called Burkhard Heim who worked on ways of creating artificial gravity. Now, doing that you think is incredible, but Burkhard Heim was doing research on explosives before the start of the Second World War. And by his name, you possibly guessed he's German, so the Nazis drafted him into the German Air Force. And he started developing new munitions, not because he wanted to, but he was just curious about how all the stuff that worked with it, and then he was forced into doing it. He was involved in an explosives accident. And bear in mind, this is 1939, 1940 at a time. The explosives accident left him deaf, blind, and without both hands. And it was after that that he came up with Heim theory, which, you know, to do theoretical physics without hands, eyes, you know, ears effectively, to do that at that time before there was any technology to give him any kind of basis to communicate is quite incredible, and ended up communicating all through his mother because she was pretty much the only person who could understand him. Now what Heim theory sort of postulated, I should say, as well as doing that, this guy wrote so much stuff that is just incredible. He predicted the existence of several groups of particles which have since proved to exist. He's also predicted an incredible number of things which have been proved. And what Heim theory basically seeks to do, there's two basically totally diverse explanations for how the world and the universe and everything in reality works. One is the general theory of relativity, which explains how things work in a large scale, so planets and all the sort of various particles and so on all work. And there's also quantum mechanics, because if you look at an atom, what's happening in an atom just doesn't make any sense by general relativity. It shouldn't happen, it shouldn't exist, but we know it does because we're here and we're discussing it. What Heim tried to do, without eyes, without ears, without hands, was come up with a physical and mathematical proof to link quantum mechanics to general relativity. I mean, the scale of that is just incredible for one person to do. But to do that, you know, at that time with no technology is incredible. Now, one of the things he came up with was that if you take photons, now photons are particles of light, and light is equally as confused as general relativity. So one of the things that Heim predicted was that photons, which are particles of light, under a strong magnetic field, would convert to gravitophotons, which would provide an artificial gravity force. Now, how you predict that from a series of mathematical calculations is beyond me, but he did. And you think, okay, well, it's fine for some deaf, blind, handless German guy to predict this, you know, 60, 70 years ago. There's actually been a series of experiments, part funded by the European Space Agency, which have produced the first evidence of artificial gravity. And they're actually now at the point where they're calculating the effect they're going to get based on the parameters they set up. So it actually looks as though artificial gravity on starships is a possibility. Now, how you create photons and magnetic fields and convert them to gravitophotons and fit that onto someone so it stick to the bottom of a starship, I don't know. That's probably a few years away yet. But, I mean, anyone who's interested in physics wants to read about Burkhard Heim, because to me, in 100 years' time, they're going to talk about him the same way they talk about Newton or Einstein, because the guy is utterly incredible. He's got a couple of pages on Wikipedia. Now, some of the stuff on there is heavy reading because it is very scientific, but I've posted the links. People can have a look. And, you know, if you're interested, you're interested. If you're not, I've probably bored you to tears for the last 5 minutes.
That's good stuff. I'm enjoying it.
Right. Another question from Celador. Says he thinks it's been discussed by or within NASA whether robots can perform exactly the same tasks as humans can in space, rendering manned explanation irrelevant. And yeah, he's absolutely right. But there is one fundamental reason for manned research, or manned space travel. In the film The Right Stuff, which was about the original seven Mercury astronauts, they asked one of the astronauts, why are they going up if the Mercury aircraft could, or the Mercury space vehicle could be flown remotely? And what the guy said was, what the people want to see is Buck Rogers. No Buck Rogers, no Bucks. So basically, if you put men up, the American people will underwrite the space budget. If you send a few lumps of technology up there, nobody cares. And there's a good proof of that, because over the past couple of years, there's been two robotic rovers crawling around the Martian surface, and they've found evidence of water. They've found evidence of life possibly existing up there, and possibly still existing, because they can only work on the surface. Now, if a man had been standing up on Mars and said, this stuff I'm putting my boot through and taking the surface off, you can see white crystalline salt, that can only come from water evaporation, and therefore water must have been on the surface and may still be subsurface, every news agency in the world would have carried that. It would have been in every new TV news program. It'd be all over the internet. It'd been every newspaper. That happened a year ago, and it's been ignored. So there's two reasons really for sending people up. One, nobody's going to finance sending up robots to the degree they're going to finance people. And the message gets out and people take more interest in it, albeit like the Apollo landings and like the space shuttle and the International Space Station. Once they've seen three or four missions, they get bored of it, but it gets the next generation of budget signed off. Next question from Mr. Alex Andronov, and I think having him and I on at the same time is guaranteed to crash the place. How did I get first interested in space? Well, I've always been interested in anything technical, and I've got this thing about trying to understand anything. And it started off, you know, cars, unsurprisingly. And when I was a kid, there was a lot more sort of coverage of space, and we didn't have as many TV channels, and we didn't have the internet. So if something like that was on, I watched it. And really, I caught the end of the Apollo program. I don't lie about my age, I'm older than I say I am. I caught the end of the Apollo program, and those guys were like rock stars, the guys who flew Apollo. They were on every TV program. When Apollo was launched, BBC would go and just sit and watch the build-up the same way NASA TV does today. and they'd watch some of the trip to the moon, and you'd have the astronauts doing tricks with drops of water showing weightlessness and how zero gravity worked. And then they show the moon landing, the flight back, and the landings and splashdown, all that stuff. So they get so much coverage that being a very young kid at the time, very, very young, because I'm only 27 now, it just had to be fascinating for you. And it's one of the reasons why I plug space so much, is because I know if people get interested in it, it's something that takes them beyond normal thinking and gets them thinking about it. And just as an example of my need to know how things work, everyone's mother has pictures that they pull out to embarrass them. But when I was a young kid, and I'm talking like 4 years old, the done thing was to get dressed up in all your Sunday best and head off to Glasgow to see Santa Claus just in the build-up to Christmas in one of the big shops. And the one my mother picked this year for the posh photos was myself, my young brother, who's a couple of years younger than me, and they had this rocking horse. Now, this isn't one of these things with the rocking chair bottom on it. This proper springs, dampers, the whole thing, with doves flying about and stuff. I mean, it was utterly ridiculous. But once we get the photos taken and gone, I was playing with something in my hand going outside, and my mother asked what it was, and it was a wing nut. She said, "Where'd you get the wing nut from?" "It's from the rocking horse." "Why?" So I was trying to figure out how it worked, so I unscrewed the wing nut. "What was the wing nut on?" "It was on one of them spring things." So she went shooting back up to the shop and discovered this kid bouncing on it just as the spring was about to come off. And in the photo, you can actually see my little brother sitting on the rocking horse with one of these doves on his head. And my hand is just partially behind my back, quite happily ignoring everything that's going on and unscrewing this wing nut to figure out how the rocking horse worked. So that's why I'm obsessed with technical stuff. Another question from Alex, which is on a slightly grander scale. Given the size of space and the fact that aliens are likely, I'd say definite, but Alex says likely, and they may be too far away for us to ever meet, if we're to meet them, do you think it's more likely we go find them or more likely they will come and find us? I think realistically, neither. What you have to realise, and I'm sure Alex does, every radio signal, and that means radio, TV, every radio wave that's ever been on the Earth has gone and is heading out into space. Now bear in mind, we've had decent radio for maybe 70 years. It's now 70 light years away from Earth, which is, effectively it's been travelling at the speed of light for 70 years, which is a very long way. I won't give it in millions of miles per hour because I'll be here all night reciting zeros. Now, what needs to happen with that is eventually some civilization is going to detect it and zone in and figure out where it's coming from and realize there's another civilization down here. But the only way they could get here, imagine, effectively, if they'd sent us a signal back, it would need to be 36, 37 years travel from Earth for them to have sent a signal back and us not to have detected it yet, although they could have sent it and we didn't. Now, there's no way we can travel that kind of distance. So the only way we're ever going to meet an alien is if there's someone way out there with warp drive who can get, you know, pick up our signal and basically home in on it all the way down. So it's more likely that someone will find us, but it's much more likely than either of those that we'll send signals to each other with, instead of the 5 second delay we had at the start of this Skype, we'll have a 40 or 50 year gap between communications. Now there is a project called the SETI project, which is the Search for International Technology and Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is basically monitoring all the radio transmissions in space, trying to detect patterns which could be other life. And I haven't actually ever done it, but apparently you can download a piece of software from SETI. I think it's SETI.org, but I'm not sure. But if you search for the SETI project, you'll find it. And you can download a piece of software and you can actually get some data sent to you. And in the background of your computer, when you're not doing anything, it will scan the radio data that's been sent or been detected. And you may be the one person on Earth who finds ET. Can't believe I haven't done that. Next question I have is from Startled Bunny. What is the procedure for an emergency evacuation from a space shuttle if things go wrong entering the Earth's atmosphere? Well, basically there isn't one. Imagine the space shuttle in Earth orbit It's doing 17,000 miles per hour. And what they do, it's going backwards. They fire up the engines for a minute or two, just to slow it enough so that its orbit starts to decay and it falls into the atmosphere. As it falls into the atmosphere, the air builds up friction against it, and the heat shield builds up heat. Now this temperature gets to something ridiculous. I meant to check the number, but I think it's something like 15,000 degrees centigrade. And that reacts, the air particles react and form a plasma at that stage, which is why if you ever actually see footage from inside a spacecraft as it's coming down, there's all this sort of green glow around it, which is like the Aurora Borealis or the Aurora Australis, where you've got just a green glow in the sky, but this is more localized. So getting out at that point would be an extremely bad idea for a number of reasons. First, you're going to fry, and second, you're probably going to hit something, and stepping out of an aircraft at 15,000 miles an hour, you're going to be in shreds probably before you even hit anything. The vehicle travels down, in the shuttle's case, comes all the way down at ridiculous speeds. And one of the comments Christine posted at the last shuttle landing we watched was, what does subsonic mean? Because just before it crossed the coast of California, which was literally a minute or two before it landed, the commentary said it was travelling now at subsonic speeds, and that is lower than the speed of sound. So even a couple of minutes before that, it's maybe doing 3, 4, 5 times the speed of sound. And there's no way you want to get out anything at that speed, because you're going to get mangled. Now, all of us have a basic grasp of the aerodynamics of a Formula One car. So, say 5 times the speed of sound, 3,500 miles an hour. Imagine an F1 driver trying to stand up and get out of the vehicle. Now, we heard in the commentary of the Italian Grand Prix, they were talking about helmet suck, which is where the airflow causes lift on the driver's helmet and tries to pull it off his head. Well, imagine he undoes his belt at 3,500 miles an hour, or 20 times normal sort of Grand Prix speed. Not only is his helmet going to get sucked out of the car, his whole body's going to be sucked out along with it. And because of the forward motion of the car and the airflow going over it, he's effectively going to be sucked straight through the back wing, round about the top of the double diffuser area, and going to get smashed to bits at 3,500 miles into all that carbon fibre. Now, on a race car, all of that stuff's going to break, which is going to help him if somebody's neck hasn't been broken, been yanked out of the car like that in the first place. The space shuttle wings are a lot more solid than that. So you step out of there at 3,500 miles an hour, you're going to hit the wing. The wing's not going to break. Your crash helmet and your body's going to break, and you're going to die. So there is no way of getting out of that thing until it lands. One advantage you've got with the Apollo type or the sort of shuttle replacement is not in landing, but in liftoff. When the shuttle launches, there is no way for the crew to separate themselves from all the stuff that's round about them, like the main body of the shuttle, the 500,000 gallons of rocket fuel. So when the shuttle actually blew up, the crew compartment stayed together, but there's no way of separating it or parachuting it down. So they stayed intact. They probably survived the blast and died from the injuries they got crashing into the ground. With the Apollo type vehicles, and it's something I forgot to mention earlier on, I was talking about stuff that gets trashed. What they have on top of the capsule, right on the point of the nose of the rocket, 300 feet up in the air, they have what they call an escape tower. And basically this is a thing that looks like a lightning conductor or a little radio tower. But what it has is a few little directional rockets pointing down and away from it. So what happens is, if they decide they have to separate, they can just blow the explosive bolts holding the capsule onto the rocket, light the escape tower, and they get pulled, you know, a couple of miles away from where the crash is actually happening. So they actually survive the accident and can parachute to Earth. They can't do that in a shuttle. If something goes wrong with a shuttle launch, you just got to hope your seatbelts are tight and you land on something soft. So you're knackered.
To put it bluntly.
Yeah.
Stephen, we've got about 4 minutes left, and you haven't told us about elephants or Major Tom.
The last two things I've got, I've just actually lined up. We had a question pop up somewhere a while back of how much does the sky weigh? And what someone's calculated is, if you take the atmosphere, which is effectively the sky, and the atmosphere belongs to Earth, so it's not space, which settles another argument. The sky or the atmosphere weighs 570 billion adult Indian elephants. So
that's quite a lot.
If you ever want to know, yeah, if you ever want to know what the sky weighed in elephants, that's it.
I would like to know now, what it weighs in pandas, actually.
Well, you need to calculate that yourself from the relative pandas. And,
okay.
Or give me more morning. Right, now on to Major Tom. There is a link I've just posted which gives you a list of everyone who's ever flown in space, astronauts, cosmonauts, that kind of thing. And I did a search through that. And out of all of those, there are two potential Major Toms. There are actually a few guys who are called Thomas, including Ken Mattingly, whose first name is Thomas, who's famous for the not going on a space mission rather than going on one, even though he did go on some, because he was the guy who pulled out of the Apollo 13 mission with suspected measles or German measles. There are two genuine candidates to be Major Tom. One is Thomas Akers, who flew in a few shuttle missions, but I don't think he was a major at any time. The other is a man with the fabulous name of Thomas Patton Stafford. Now, he is best known as being the commander of Apollo 10, which was the mission which did the dry run on the Apollo 11 moon landings. And he actually commanded that, got in the lunar module, went down to within several hundred feet of the moon's surface, and then had to light the rocket and come back up. Now, one thing you have to bear in mind with all US military personnel who flew in early space missions, so Mercury, which was the one-man rocket, Gemini, which was the two-man rocket, and then Apollo, which was three men, every time they flew in space, they got a promotion in their service. And Stafford flew a few times, and actually flew in the shuttle, being the first officer ever of rank of general to fly in space. And if you look through the US Air Force rankings, which I haven't posted that link yet, have I? Yeah, I have. The ranks of commissioned officers for US Air Force officers, you can see he flew in space enough times that on one of those missions, he must have been Major Tom. Now, I can't work out which mission it's on because I don't know what other promotions he got beyond his NASA promotions, but Major Tom, I am 99.9 certain, was Tom Stafford, the commander of Apollo 10, which was the one where you see them walking out to this thing with a blown-up Snoopy to side because they called one of their modules Snoopy and another one Charlie Brown. So Thomas Stafford, I am almost certain, is Major Tom. What relevance that has to David Bowie? No idea. Only leads me to close with saying, side pod space out. Beam me up, Scotty.
Cheers, Stephen.
Thank you.